gardening in harmony with nature.
And these were ladybug larvae that were there in response to the aphids, and they were just gobbling up the aphids by the thousands. It was incredible. And just by waiting a few days and realizing, nature's already spotted the aphid problem. It's a food source for these ladybug larvae, and there they are. Within a few days, the aphid problem was completely gone.
That's Toby Hemenway. He's just reissued his classic, Gaia's Garden.
I like to say that the backyard homestead is as much a state of mind as it is an actual place.
And that's Carlene Madigan. She tells us how to feed ourselves with a backyard homestead, no matter how small.
What I found so compelling and powerful was that though they had endured forced labor, agricultural labor, the first thing they wanted to do when they came here was to plant a garden in the old tradition before Pol Pot.
Patricia Clindines tells us how gardens help immigrants preserve their culture and nurture their souls. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. We're producing this show on Memorial Day, traditionally the day we here in New England start gardening in earnest. We tenderly lay our precious tomato plants into their outside beds, and if the soil's warm enough, sow the beans. Many gardeners are following the example of our First Lady, Michelle Obama. They're planting organic gardens. They're doing it because organic vegetables taste better, they're safer for the gardener to grow, and they're better for the planet. But author Toby Hemenway says cutting chemical pesticides out of the garden is just the beginning of gardening in harmony with the environment. He calls for ecological gardening, not imposing the will of the gardener on the environment, but observing what's around us and going with the flow with wildlife, the weather, and the ecology of our own backyards. Hemenway's just out with a new edition of his 2001 book, Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture. Your book, Gaia's Garden, is about sustainable gardening. Lay out the parameters for us here. What is sustainable gardening?
Well, it certainly begins with a garden that doesn't rely very much on non-renewable resources like fossil fuels and that kind of thing. And organic is just really a starting point. But really what it is a garden that tries to mimic the processes that go on in nature. You know, if you think about you walk into a forest and it looks absolutely beautiful and you walk in 3 months later and it looks just fine, and I think we all know that if we leave our gardens alone for 3 months, they're either a jungle or a desert or a little bit of both. And so what permaculture gardens try to do is figure out what it is that nature is doing to be so sustainable with so little outside input and do that in our backyards.
Now, you just used the word permaculture. Tell us what permaculture is in the large sense of it, and then I'm going to ask you how you apply it to the home gardener, the small-scale gardener.
Right. Well, permaculture was originally a contraction of the two words permanent agriculture. It was developed in Australia by a guy named Bill Mollison, who looked at the kind of degradation of the landscape and just the fact that so little of what we're doing seems to be sustainable. And he was a forester and ecologist, and he made that a similar observation to what I was just talking about, that what is it that makes a forest do so well all the time? And he spent a lot of years trying to figure that out, just what is nature doing that allows things to be so renewable, you know, that when it rains on a forest, it gets bigger and greener, and when the sun shines on a forest, it gets greener, and when it rains on our house, the roof leaks, and when the sun shines on our house, the paint peels. So what's the difference there? And so he spent some time figuring out what it was that nature was doing. Kind of, you can think of permaculture as applied ecology. It's how do we design our own landscapes and communities and even businesses and things like that so that they have the same resilience and productivity and renewability that nature does. And as far as on the garden scale, it's working a lot with perennial plants, not so much with annuals, because nature tends to favor a lot of perennials, perennial grasses and perennial trees and those sorts of things, and figuring out ways to keep water in your landscape and build up the soil so that it's full of rich organic matter, and really try and create a backyard that's in the model of a forest or of a prairie, except that it's got a role for the gardener in it as well as being really good for wildlife.
You're really describing a kind of, as you said, ecological gardening. What is a typical backyard ecosystem like? What are the typical elements of a backyard ecosystem?
Okay, well, there's probably a place that is catching rainwater from the roof. It might be a pond, or it might be some tanks or a cistern, so that we're harvesting things that are coming into our yards, like rainwater to start with. It may even have a gray water system, so that shower and laundry water is captured rather than going down the sewer. And that goes into a wetland, like a bog garden, that then treats that water and purifies it again so it can be used for irrigation, for watering plants. So that would be one feature of it, is making sure that the water is taken care of. And probably it has garden beds that have been mulched pretty deeply, because that's how nature builds soil, is by putting mulch down. By, you know, the leaves fall on the ground and they build up the soil. Nature doesn't really rototill and that sort of thing, so we're building soil the same way nature does. And there are stacked layers of plants in it. It's not just grasses or flowers, but it's a mixture of low ground covers and perennial and annual flowers, shrubs, berry bushes, fruit trees, nut trees. You can think of it kind of like it might even be a forest garden, just a lovely little woodland, not a deep, dark forest, but a little woodland garden. And so it attracts pollinators and does all kinds of good things with nature, but also there are places in it for people too. There's food and fruit and lovely places to hang out and water features and that. But it also, because it's capturing water and building soil and attracting beneficial insects and attracting birds and all of that, it's doing really great things for nature and people at the same time.
Now, you say backyard, but what kind of scale are we talking about, and how small can this go?
Well, I've seen people do permaculture gardens on their apartment balconies. Just it's really more just how you design it. There aren't any specific features that have to be in a sustainable or a permaculture landscape. It's really more of an attitude about, okay, how can we maximize our use of sunlight and fit as much into a small space as we possibly can, and how can we conserve water, and how can we make sure that there's a role for pollinators and wildlife in our garden, and also something that produces for us. And you can do that in a container garden on a balcony, or you can do it on 5,000 acres or anything in between. You just use different strategies and different techniques depending on the scale you're working on.
Well, I have a balcony, and I usually, you know, grow a few vegetables and pots there. But how would it be different, what I do there, from just any other kind of container gardening, if I were doing it the way you explain in your book, Gaia's Garden?
Well, you might even try and catch a little bit of rainwater somehow and use that a little bit for your watering. Or you might, say, water some of your plants with water from your kitchen sink that you've caught. Would be one little way to do that. But you also could make sure that you have a balance of plants that not only offer things to you, but also offer things for nature, like flowers that will attract beneficial insects and that sort of thing. You might even have a worm bin, you know, a way of making worm compost, using worms inside a nice container that doesn't smell, that people can keep in their apartment or on their balcony, and make compost that way and build up the soil in your plant pots through a worm bin. So those are just a few of the things you could add in.
Now, you mentioned the word wildlife there before. You say in your book, Gaia's Garden, that this kind of ecological gardening is edible landscaping meeting wildlife gardening. Tell us how you would deal with that bane of gardeners, deer.
Right. Well, you would use a bunch of different strategies, and that's one of the approaches that permaculture takes, is you try and understand what it is you're dealing with and understand their habits and the life cycle and that sort of thing. Like, I had a problem with deer when I used to live in a rural area in southern Oregon, and there was a deer trail coming up from the southeast, and I first put up a temporary fence and then built a hedge pointing kind of towards the southeast, a semicircular hedge, and it was full of all sorts of wildlife plants like wild apricots and wild plums and some types of wild roses. And once it got established, I took the little temporary fence down, and what it did was it acted just to deflect the deer enough from the main part of my garden. They'd encounter the hedge, and they'd wander off to the side, and often they didn't come back into the garden itself. Now, I actually did wind up later, here's another technique. We still had some deer problem because my next-door neighbor started feeding the deer, and that changed all their habits. Instead of coming from the southeast, they started coming down the road, and so I got a dog. And dogs are pretty well known for not being very friendly to deer. So I used a multi-pronged approach. I mean, I tried all the other stuff for deer. I hung up bars of soap and, you know, did all sorts of other little techniques like that. But I really found that a dog was much more effective. Often if you have an animal problem, the solution is another animal.
So you kind of use the carrot first and then the stick.
Right.
You know, here we have human intervention. You address another issue in your book, which I was curious about, and that is exotics versus native plants. What's your take on them? First of all, what are the problems with exotics? And,
sure.
And then tell us what your ideas are.
Okay, well, most people there are certainly a lot of movements around these days to eliminate exotic invasive plants, that pretty much wherever you live, there is, like here in the Northwest, it's blackberry and English ivy are two things that are really invasive. And there are other plants in New England, say it's bittersweet, or there are lots and lots of plants, kudzu in the Southeast. And these are plants that come in and they kind of take over in some ways. But it turns out that the problem is rarely the plant itself. It's usually some sort of disturbance or development or building a road or cutting down trees or just constantly disturbing the soil, something like that, that creates perfect conditions for this invader to come in, for this other plant to move in. And so if you want to get rid of these so-called invasive species, just spraying them or yanking them out isn't going to do any good, because you've got conditions there that are much better for the invasive plant, for this exotic plant, than they are for the natives. So how can natives possibly compete when human beings have created the perfect conditions for exotic plants to come moving in? And they'll keep doing it. Nature is patient and relentless, and we can yank and spray all we want. And as soon as we relax our guard a little bit, nature will come back in and bring that same plant right back in again. So it really takes a different approach. I mean, I also think the whole concept of native plants, I mean, native to where? Native to just this yard, or native to this county, or native to this state, or native to this planet. You know, most plants came from somewhere else. There are very few plants that actually evolved right where they are today. You know, where I live in the Pacific Northwest used to have hippopotamus and fig trees in it not all that long ago, in terms of geologic time. But neither of those are native now, and no one would think so. Even our native Douglas fir didn't evolve in Oregon. It came from somewhere else. So at one point, it was an invasive species. So it really requires, I think, thinking about these things a little bit differently. And, I mean, we have become stewards of the planet in a way. We don't really have a choice anymore. So it's up to us to make wise decisions about, all right, what do we want in the way of vegetation or animals around us? And to make wise choices about that. What kind of conditions are we going to create? Are we going to attract blackberries and brambles, or do we want to attract beneficial insects and wonderful wildflowers? And we just have to create the conditions that will attract the things that we want. So it's a huge and complex issue, but it doesn't really boil down to that plant is bad and it deserves to die. It's usually we created the conditions that brought it in. I mean, even the dreaded purple loosestrife that infests a lot of swamps and things, turns out that it's a great plant for cleaning up pollution, and that is why it's there. It's because our wetlands are now polluted. So purple loosestrife has a better chance of success than the so-called natives that used to be there. We've created the conditions for invasives to appear.
And I'm speaking with Toby Hemenway. He's just come out with the second edition of his book, Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture. Now, you, in this book, when you talk about permaculture, You talk about some of its principles, and reading them over was almost like a mindfulness meditation. For example, you talk about observing, connecting. I'd like you to take some of these principles and give us some examples of them. I mean, let's start with observe.
Sure. Well, and that really is at the top of the list, that before you start doing almost anything or designing anything or making a plan, you really have to know what's there. I mean, it's really our temptation to just jump in and start changing things. And there's an old gardener's saying of wait 1 year, that in a perfect world, you would wait through the whole turn of the seasons and when you're in a new landscape before you do anything. Now, of course, we never can. We start right out. But I made the mistake in my backyard when I first moved to Portland. It was in the fall, and I was going to plant garlic because that's something we do here in the fall. And I found an empty place in the yard, and I planted garlic. And it turned out the next spring when I started seeing the garlic that was a big bed of daffodil bulbs. And I just didn't know that the bulbs were 2 inches below where I'd planted the garlic. So if I'd waited, I would have seen that, and I wouldn't have risked eating toxic daffodils instead of delicious garlic. You have, observation is the first step. What is there? What's going on? Even though it's hard sometimes to wait long enough to make those observations.
Yes. Now, how about connect? What are you doing with that principle?
Right. Well, when you're designing something, design is not just having a bunch of cool stuff. It's about putting those interesting, useful things in the right relationships to one another. I mean, that's what a design really is. It's figuring out where things go to put them in the best place. So that, say, in a backyard, if you've got chickens and compost and vegetables, you might want to have your compost on the way to the chicken so that you can carry your compost out from the kitchen, throw out the, say, orange rinds and things that the chickens won't eat, and then carry your compost bucket out to the chickens, give them the rest of the kitchen scraps, pick up their eggs, and then walk back in to the house all in one trip instead of making a trip to get eggs, a trip to feed the chickens, a trip to do the compost, and that sort of thing. So by placing those pieces in the right relationships, or putting a salad bed right on the path from your car door into your house. So you park your car, you're home from work, and you gather salad greens as you come inside, so that when you get inside and it's dark and you're kind of tired, you've already got a fresh salad picked rather than having to make another trip back outside, which you're probably not going to do. You're going to pull something out of the fridge and eat it. So placing things in the right relationships saves work and saves energy and creates a much, much more effective design.
You also talk about making the least change for the greatest effect. Give us some examples of that.
Right. Well, the classic example is simply planting a seed. Here's a very, very small action, and it has huge, huge effects. You know, how really what the principle means is where can you make a little change, a little move of some sort, intervene in a small way, and suddenly get a really big change out of it, instead of kind of having to bludgeon things with a giant hammer to make things move.
Well, what about, for example, with pest control? How would that principle apply there?
Right. Well, there, actually, I had an example just a little while ago of last season. I noticed that the tips of my cherry tree were all turning black, and I went up and looked at them, and it was an infestation of incredible numbers of aphids. It was just unbelievable, and I was really freaked out. You know, oh no, I'm going to lose a lot of the leaves off the cherry. And I was ready to go out and buy some sort of insecticidal soap, an organic soap to spray on the tree, and I was all set to do it, and I kind of waited a few days because I was busy with other things, and I went back out and looked at the aphids, and suddenly I saw all these little alligator-like critters running around, these little tiny creatures about a quarter of an inch long that looked like little miniature alligators, and these were ladybug larvae that were there in response to the aphids, and they were just gobbling up the aphids by the thousands. It was incredible. And just by waiting a few days and realizing, nature's already spotted the aphid problem. It's a food source for these ladybug larvae, and there they are. So really, this was not even making the least change. For me, this was doing a little observation and doing nothing. And within a few days, the aphid problem was completely gone, and I had tons of ladybugs that year because I'd fed them so well on the aphids.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. Now, you also have some principles that are based on attitudes. You talk about turning problems into solutions. I don't know if waiting, the one you just gave, is an example of that, but I'm sure that you have some others. How would you turn a problem into a solution?
Right. Well, let me tell a story about a friend of mine who lived on a busy street, but also had really, really terrible soil in his yard, and they just moved there. And they decided, okay, we're going to build up the soil, we're going to compost, we're going to mulch, but we also really want to get started in a hurry, so we're just going to order a truckload of garden soil. And so the dump truck came and dropped off a huge pile, 10 yards of garden soil. And as the driver was getting into the truck, they thought to ask him, say, where'd that soil come from anyway? And the driver said, oh, these cotton fields outside of town. And these were organic gardeners, and cotton is one of the most pesticide-intensive crops you can grow because it's not a food crop. And they realized, oh, great, we've just gotten 10 yards of pesticide-saturated soil, and we do not want to garden in this. And they realized that instead of having to, you know, truck away this soil again, they realized they lived on a busy street that was no privacy, and they made adobe blocks out of this garden soil. They mixed it with some clay and a little bit of cement, dried it in the sun, made adobe blocks, and built this beautiful wall around their corner out of this toxic soil, and then plastered it over with an earthen plaster to contain all of the toxins in it. And now they took this problem of 10 yards of toxic soil and not only solved the problem of the soil and got rid of that, but they created a privacy screen and a noise barrier for the busy street that they lived on. So this is the kind of thinking. I mean, I wish I were smart enough to come up with stuff like this, but where they not only solve the original problem, but they solve some other problems with the same solution.
That's
so if we think cleverly like that, we can do this sort of thing.
Again, kind of pulling back and seeing the big picture for the ecological view.
Right, exactly. Just think about all the things that are going on. You know, they did good observation there. What are all the problems we need to solve, and how many can we solve with one change? And there's that least change for the greatest effect principle as well. So they all these principles sort of stick together. You do one, and you wind up doing several others at the same time.
Now, you also have another principle of attitude called positive feedback loops. Usually, these days, we're thinking of positive feedback loops in a very negative way because we're thinking about climate change. You know, this is where moving off the equilibrium creates a change that makes you move off equilibrium even more. So what kind of positive feedback loops are you talking about in your book, Gaia's Garden?
Right. Well, another example of that, because, right, we do have this image of positive feedback can send things out of control. And so you do have to be careful. But on a small scale, for example, with a gray water wetland, say, we're catching shower and laundry water, and normally this would just go down into the sewer, but through a gray water wetland, the little bits of soap and dirt and food particles and things that would normally be wasted go into the gray water wetland, and they start to grow plants, and you've got water as well. So what you're doing is, by harvesting a little bit of these nutrients, you grow a few plants there, and then there's more fertility and more lushness because of the plants that you're growing in your wetland, and more plants start to go, and you accumulate a little bit more stuff that you would consider pollution, these soap bits and skin flakes and food particles and things. But your wetland in your backyard loves this stuff, and the microbes there and the plants there keep growing and growing and growing, and the more that they harvest, the bigger and healthier they get, and so the more that they can grow. And so you've created this positive feedback system of a little bit creates a little bit more, creates a little bit more, creates a little bit more, until, I mean, right now my little backyard wetland has, well, not this time of year, but later it'll have canna lilies in it that are 9 feet tall, bigger than any of my neighbors, because it loves this artificial wetland that I have.
Now, before Toby Hemingway, you earlier on in our interview, you mentioned edible forestry, and there's actually one that's near here in Holyoke. Holyoke is it's a low-income city that's very dense and urbanized. And this was created by Eric Tonesmeyer.
Oh, sure.
Who has written a compendious guide, a two-volume guide to edible forestry. Tell us about growing a food forest in the backyard.
Right. Well, I'm just going to talk about a kind of an urban to small suburban yard, something that's much less than a quarter acre and maybe, you know, maybe quite a bit less. But all you really need to do is have a backbone of a few of your favorite small fruit trees, dwarf or semi-dwarf trees that don't get too big, and those serve as a backbone. But then what you do is plant other plants around these that serve a bunch of different purposes. One is you'd like to bring in some flowers that will help attract pollinators and beneficial insects to help your fruit trees, or nut trees if you have those. And you also want plants that will help build the soil, plants that, say, there's a whole group of plants called nitrogen fixers, the pea family, which adds nitrogen to the soil. So that's another group of plants that you can bring in and plant around your fruit trees. You might bring in some shade-tolerant berry bushes like currants that have an edible crop but don't really need all that much sun. You could bring in plants that are really good for creating mulch, again, for helping to build up the soil. So there are lots of plants that have great fleshy leaves that you can slash down and leave right in place to create mulch like artichokes or comfrey or things like that. And so you bring in different types of plants and other organisms that perform all the jobs that are needed by a forest garden. Rather than you having to be out there and gather mulch or bring in fertilizer or bring in bee colonies and raise bees so that you have pollinators, you just plant different things that do all the different jobs that need to be done. There are plants that will build fertility in the soil, plants to attract pollinators. So you bring in all these different plants to work with your fruit trees and berry bushes and things like that, and pretty soon they grow so much faster and healthier and don't need spraying and don't need fertilizing, so you wind up having this lovely food-producing forest in your backyard.
Now let's pull the lens back a little bit. There's a movement here that's growing in this country for food security that is concerned about things like peak oil, where we may not be able, food may get very, very expensive if it's imported from elsewhere, from far away. People talk about food miles and growing locally. How does your book fit into that larger movement for creating more of our sustenance right here at home?
Well, part of it is just simply awareness, understanding that food doesn't just come from a supermarket, and I think that that's one of the things that my book and a lot of others tries to get across, is that it's easy and it's a lot of fun to grow a little bit of food. And I also think in terms of you can do a little bit for yourself and then get involved with your community so that there can be local food production. Like, for example, there is an urban community-supported agriculture group. Actually, there are several of them here in Portland where the farmer who runs this CSA as community-supported agriculture is called, the farmer here borrows about 20 different yards from people in Portland who've given him permission to grow different vegetable crops on their yards. And once a week, we all come over to his main garden, and he has boxes and boxes and boxes of vegetables that he's gathered on his bicycle and brought to the main collecting garden from all the 20 that he has. And so I grow some plants here myself, some food myself, but I also get a lot of food from this CSA. And I also get a lot of food from local farmers markets, and then I get food from a larger area, the ones that I can't get locally. So it's kind of this multi-tiered approach of, no, it's really not feasible for me to grow all of my own food all by myself in my backyard, but I grow a little of it here and then gradually try and get more and more of my food from more and more local sources. So some's from my yard, some's from a CSA, some's from the farmer's market, but as much of it as possible is local. And also that provides you with a lot of food security, because if something goes wrong with my garden or the farmer's market or something like that, I have a backup or two or three. so that I'm a great deal more food secure than someone who's just reliant on trucks coming in from California all the time.
Well, Toby Hemenway, your book is Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture. This has just been a wonderful conversation about a topic that is certainly one of my favorites, as well as many, many listeners.
Well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you.
Toby Hemenway. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about the Sunroot Garden CSA in Portland, Oregon, Toby Hemenway talked about. We're talking about gardens today. Later, we'll hear about some ethnic gardens from Patricia Klindienst. But next, we talk with Carlene Madigan about the backyard homestead. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. With as little as a quarter acre, you can harvest 1,400 eggs, 50 pounds of wheat, 60 pounds of fruit, 2,000 pounds of vegetables, and 75 pounds of nuts. That's a lot of food on the table. You've only got a little balcony, you say? No problem. Some tomatoes, peppers, and lettuce grow better in containers. And you can preserve your harvest to enjoy through the winter. It's all laid out in a great little guide by my guest, Carlene Madigan. Her book is The Backyard Homestead. You know, your wonderful book, The Backyard Homestead, the subtitle is Produce All the Food You Need on a Quarter Acre. A quarter acre? How?
Yes. With a lot of work. it is possible, especially if you're just one or two people in your family. But I do like to remind people to start off small with, you know, if you've never gardened before, just try, you know, one bed or even one plant in a container to get going and dip your toe in before you go off whole hog. It's a great dream to be able to grow all of your own food and keep chickens and honeybees and all of that. And you can definitely get to that point, but it's a good idea to start off small.
Now, have you done this yourself?
I've done bits and pieces of all of these things over the years.
And before we go on, all of these things is gardening, some permaculture, right, in terms of berry bushes and apple trees or things of that kind, raising small livestock, including bees, chickens, ducks. So I'll ask you again, have you done this?
When I got out of college, I lived on a farm outside of Boston for a while and actually had volunteered there while I was in college. And so that's kind of where I, you know, started becoming interested in all of these topics. And we had rabbits and kept pigs, and I milked the goats and had a little vegetable garden and chickens, you know, for eggs and meat and all of these things. So I kind of picked up a little bit along the way just from working on this farm and have tried to incorporate parts of, you know, producing my own food wherever I go, whether I'm living in a more urban area or where I live now out in the country.
Well, as you said, you can start very small, even with container gardening. And I have done everything from when I owned my own home, I had a lot of gardens. Now that I rent, I do have I do some container gardening. And you point out that in the case of certain vegetables, you actually can produce more with a container garden. Talk a little bit about that.
That's true, especially with, living in a cold climate where we do, it's hard to get enough heat for plants like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants. And especially if you're using what's called a self-watering container to give the plant a very steady supply of water. Even if you're not using a self-watering container, just having those kinds of heat-loving plants in containers raises the soil moisture, the soil temperature, which helps them produce a lot better than they would if they were in the ground.
A self-watering container now, is this something that you have to buy, or can you actually make them yourself?
You can make them yourself. It's basically just the idea of bottom watering. So if you go online to or even at your local garden center, I think they sell these kits for houseplants. Like when you go away on vacation, it's kind of it's hard to explain, but it basically works by capillary action. So you're running a wick from the soil of the container you're growing in into a kind of a bucket of water. So it keeps the moisture supply constant. The self-watering containers that you buy are just a more elaborate version of that.
Obviously, you can, you know, make your choice of vegetables, but what are some of the guidelines, what are some of the general principles of putting in a backyard homestead? And first of all, explain what you mean by homestead.
Well, I like to say that the backyard homestead is as much a state of mind as it is an actual place. So it's all of the skills that you can learn about in the backyard homestead. It's not just about the physical act of growing vegetables or raising animals, but it's also about the process of making food. So making cheese and making your own sausage. And you can do those things whether or not you raise animals or grow your own vegetables. So you can make cheese whether or not you milk a goat, but you can certainly learn how. But I think that some of the basic things to start with are just, you know, looking at the exposure your yard has. So how much sun do you get every day? Vegetables and most fruiting plants also need quite a lot of sun. Also talk to your neighbors, especially if you're interested in keeping animals. I mean, that's a really big commitment. You should consider it much like getting a pet. If you were going to get a dog, you wouldn't just say, hey, I'm going to go run out and pick up a dog from the shelter and bring it home. You really have to consider what your lifestyle is like and how much time and effort you want to put into taking care of the animal. And with farm animals in particular, there are a lot of, you know, towns that don't allow you to keep chickens or pigs or other animals within the city limits. So you have to be very careful about that too. So I definitely recommend that people start with just a very simple vegetable garden, maybe a few strawberry plants. Make sure you have good soil, get a load of compost delivered, and just go for it. Just, you know, don't be afraid. People are afraid to kill something that they plant. But I really just encourage people to not think about the rules and just kind of dive in and have fun and see what happens. And if something goes wrong, use it as an opportunity to learn about the plant and what you can do better next time.
Well, Carlene Madigan, in your book, The Backyard Homestead, you actually have plans for homesteads of different sizes. So give us an idea. How much could you grow on a quarter acre? How much could you grow or have, because it's not just growing, it's also raising animals, on a half an acre? Give us a sense of the difference between the two. Give us some examples of what you could have on a quarter acre, what you could have on a half an acre.
Right. Well, I consulted with a number of our authors. I should say that I'm an editor at Story Publishing, and this book is a compilation of story material that is all about raising animals and growing food. And so I consulted with a number of authors when I was putting this book together, and in particular, these plans that we have for, you know, how to set up your homestead on different sizes of property. And I was kind of surprised. I was chatting with Carolee Carius, who has written a number of poultry books for us, and it's surprising how many chickens in particular you can have on a fairly small piece of property. So she told me that it's pretty easy to have six chickens in just a small corner of a tenth of an acre lot. And six chickens, if you think about it, in their prime production, produce about an egg a day. It's a little bit less than that, but so an egg a day from six chickens is a lot of eggs a week. So you're getting half a dozen eggs a day. So what we did was we took all of these kind of ballpark calculations of what you can produce from a vegetable garden of a certain size and keeping a couple of pigs and a couple of chickens. And the back cover goes through how much you can produce of each of these things. So from a quarter of an acre, you can get something in the neighborhood of 1,400 eggs in a year, 2,000 pounds of vegetables, 280 pounds of pork, 75 pounds of nuts, and 60 pounds of fruit. And of course, all of these things are highly dependent on where you live, the kind of climate you have, how much rain you get, and certainly with the vegetables, what kinds of vegetables you grow. If you grow a lot of potatoes and things that are heavy, you can get to 2,000 pounds pretty quickly. So
now, this also depends on how much time you have. I mean, is this like a full-time occupation to raise the kind of food that you're talking about on a quarter acre, or is this something that somebody who has a job could actually do?
There are definitely parts of this that anybody can do, depending on your level of interest. I always like to refer to a family that I read about online in Pasadena, California, and they have a website called The Path to Freedom. And it's a family of four. They're gardening on, I think it's a tenth of an acre. And they have a few, you know, small animals also, dairy goats and chickens mostly. And they grow enough of their own food to feed their entire family. And they have a small business supplying restaurants and a local CSA. So it is possible, but really that is their full-time job. I'm not sure most people would kind of go to that level. But you can do an awful lot. And if you start with things like berry bushes or strawberries, things that are perennial, so plants that will come back every year, once you get the beds prepared and get some good compost in there and get the plants in and well mulched, there's really very little to do every year besides weeding and picking the berries and kind of keeping an eye out for certain pests and diseases. But if you choose your plants correctly or wisely, you shouldn't have too much of a problem with that.
I lived in a little village in France for about 8 months in 2001, 2002.
Oh, nice.
And there was about 100 people who lived in that village. And one of the people there did raise chickens, and he raised them in a little plot of land that was right smack in the center of the village. And he solicited from his neighbors scraps, kitchen scraps. Mm. And anybody who would give him kitchen scraps, which you would just go and throw in, you know, when you had them, he would then come around and give you eggs. And I thought that was a lovely example of how you can share the burden and share the wealth as well.
Absolutely. I love that kind of community operation. I recently read a book called The Good, Good Pig, and it was a similar situation. Of course, the pig wasn't being raised for its meat. He was kind of more of a pet and became the town pet, but everyone in town knew this pig and, you know, brought him scraps from local restaurants and just from extra meals that they had, and it's a very sweet story. So it's, I think it's true. I think that you can achieve a lot more with that kind of community action and community support.
You also, in your book, and I'm speaking with Carlene Madigan about her book, The Backyard Homestead, you also in your book talk about such pleasurable activities as wine, beer, and beer making. This is also something you can do from your own homestead?
You can. Certain parts of the beer making process, so you can grow your own hops. And recently, I think in the past year or two, there's been quite a hops shortage in the world. So the backyard hops growers have been in a good place. You can grow your own hops. You can grow barley to malt for the beer making process. I think even easier than that is winemaking, because you can do that from any number of different kinds of fruit. My dad used to make a blackberry wine from blackberries that he foraged, and that was really delicious. So this year it's kind of on my list of things that I want to do is try winemaking.
And speaking of hops being in short supply, there's been a terrible devastation of beehives, especially commercial beehives. You talk about growing backyard hives. Talk about that. I mean, is there a danger of colony collapse disorder in backyard hives, or are they a little bit more resilient for this, resistant?
From what I understand, any hive can be susceptible to colony collapse disorder. I don't know if they've actually found the real cause of that, but certainly there's a lot of concern, particularly in industrial orchards where they kind of cart bees from one location to the next. So you can certainly do your own part in keeping your own vegetable garden healthy and productive, and the gardens in your neighborhood by keeping a beehive. I think a lot of people don't realize the role that bees play in producing food for us, not just honey, but in pollinating all of the plants that then produce food for us. So if there were no bees, you wouldn't have any vegetables or fruit. So that's really one thing that you can do. And also the honey is good too. So, but it's, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all this sounds like it might be very complicated. I mean, in your book, The Backyard Homestead, it's really a how-to book. You've got a lot of wonderful tips about a huge array of things, from raising chickens and pigs and goats, and milking them, by the way, and then making cheese, doing gardens, doing hives. Is this really something that one can learn from a book like yours, or does it take a whole lot more training to do that?
I think The Backyard Homestead is a good starting point for people, and that's really how I conceived of the idea, was to look at the material that Story produces, and we have whole books on each of these topics, really, and just try and get the most basic starter information from each of those topics and compile them into one place for people who are just interested in getting started in it but don't know where to go right off the bat. So I think that anybody can pick up this book and be inspired by what's in it and then want to go out and learn more from other books. You're not going to find everything you need to know, to raise goats or chickens in this book, but it's a good starting point, and you can kind of move out from there to learn more. But certainly anybody can do this.
And the book is The Backyard Homestead. Produce all the food you can eat on just a quarter acre. Carlene Madigan says you can raise as much as 14, you can get as much as 1,400 eggs, 50 pounds of wheat, 60 pounds of fruit, 2,000 pounds of vegetables, 280 pounds of pork, and 75 pounds of nuts just from a backyard homestead. Carlene Madigan, thanks so much for coming in and talking about your book, The Backyard Homestead.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Before becoming an editor at Story Press, Carlene Madigan was managing editor of Horticulture magazine. And finally, The Gardens of Ethnic Americans. We talked with Patricia Clindings in 2006 about her book, The Earth Knows My Name. It's about how gardens created by immigrants have enabled them to preserve their culture, deal with the traumas they've suffered, and create spiritual as well as physical sustenance. Here, Clindings talked with us about three gardens in western Massachusetts where we produce a show: the Italian garden of architect Tulio Iglesias, the garden of Cambodian refugees from the Pol Pot genocide, and Nuestras Raíces in Holyoke's Latino community. Patricia Clindings, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
In your book, The Earth Knows My Name, you include three local gardens, which I think is a pretty high number for a small area.
It is, but you have a lot going on up there, and it was very rich and interesting.
One of them was Tulio Iglesias' garden, and tell us a little bit about Tulio. Many folks around here probably know him as an architect.
Yes.
But tell us about the garden angle and what the connection is.
Well, I met Tulio actually through Nuestras Raíces, because he donated his time to help draw up the plans for their new building years ago. So Tulio grew up as a shepherd boy in the mountains of Italy in the Abruzzi, and he came here when he was about 9 after World War II with his father. And he is well known in the Amherst area as an eco-architect, a green architect. And what I realized when I met him and began asking him about his gardens and his architecture and his home in Italy is that it's all integrated together. He lived in this magnificent high mountain range, La Maella, and this little tiny town called Rocca Caramanico, where all the buildings were made of stone. And they had a completely sustainable rural village, you know, interdependent communities. The buildings were even attached to each other. And then he began describing his work in architecture, and, you know, he proposed the green roofs of Amherst. He's had amazing gardens wherever he goes. And his new house in Leverett, the house itself is designed to harvest sun and rain and feed the rain into his garden. He's terraced the whole landscape. So we stood on his roof the first time I was there, and I stood there and I looked down on this, and the more I thought about it and listened to him, the more I realized the whole landscape he's created in Leverett reflects his heritage from his mountain village in Italy, where everything was made of stone.
And reading about his childhood was a very poignant experience. There's a very sharp sense of loss mm-hmm. of the old way. It's extremely vivid.
Yes, and I think it surprised Tullio as well, and I found this in all the interviews I did across the country, that people have somehow accommodated this sense of loss. And I think it's very, very important for Americans to understand this, that their past could and perhaps should be our future, not in some nostalgic sense of trying to recreate a simpler past, but in the wisdom of the way they lived on the land, their self-sufficiency and the dignity and respect for work that they had. I think Tullio's grief for the loss of that life is the loss of a kind of beauty and silence and integrity. It's very hard to find here.
Yes, and he makes a contrast between quality and quantity.
Yeah, that I think what really struck me is how he said, you know, these people lived extremely well and they ate extremely well in their village, and it was really the war that destroyed their life ways, and Italy was very poor. And when they came here, he said, a lot of people, he watched a lot of immigrants sell out in that they entered the wage economy and they began to move faster and faster so they could buy consumer goods, and suddenly they had more, but they also had less. They had less free time. They had less beauty in their lives. They had less community. They had less peace of mind, ultimately.
Well, community is a connection you really make in your book. Talk a little bit about the Khmer community and how gardening was a path to healing for them.
That's something I learned from watching and listening to them as I listened to Sokhen Mao and his cousin Maden tell their stories. Each of them spent the first part of their lives in Cambodia and then fled to the border camps, the UN camps in Thailand. And they described quite vividly for me what it meant for their parents' generation, who had endured terrible upheaval and fear and torture and starvation and forced labor. And what I found so compelling and powerful was that though they had endured forced labor, agricultural labor, the first thing they wanted to do when they came here was to plant a garden in the old tradition before Pol Pot, and to grow their own food and to stay connected to the earth. They were traditional rice growers in their village in Cambodia, and they also had their own vegetable gardens and fruit trees all around. So to try to recreate that landscape, I realized that walking the garden, I could see how hard they were working, but that work was actually pleasure for them, because in America there's so little for them to do. It's hard for them to learn the language because of the trauma they've suffered in their age. But they feel useful and they feel strong. They can use the skills they've learned in the garden again, and they bring life out of the earth. They bring life out of this terrible experience.
You speak about an older woman who had scars around her wrists and her ankles.
Yes. She had been chained to a post. She and her husband were captured by the Khmer Rouge. And during the genocide of Cambodia, anyone who was educated was suspect, and anyone who was a soldier was most likely executed, and she was forced to watch her husband executed. They kept her chained, thinking she might be Vietnamese or a spy, and she said, you know, give me a piece of rope, and I'm a farmer, I'm a Cambodian farmer, and if you'll give me a piece of rope, I'll tie you a cow leash, I'll show you. So they untied her hands, and she did that, and they let her go back into the fields, and they said to her, we don't have to kill you, you're going to die anyway.
And she didn't die, and she and other folks from the Khmer community grow some incredible vegetables. I had never heard of them, and I'm all eager now to try them.
I had never heard of them either, and you know, all the different kinds of basil. My mother's family was Italian, so I knew Genovese basil, but I didn't know farm crab basil or fish cheek basil, and all these amazing basils. So Kane would pick them and hand them to me and let me taste them. They're these beautiful little cherry eggplants that actually are perfectly round and green, the size of an apple.
And they're sweet.
Yes, it was quite sweet. And the beautiful long winter melons and the bitter melons that Sokane had wonderful stories about. And what I loved about that garden was that Sokane and his family knew not only the names of everything they grew, but they knew the traditions associated with them. Their names in Cambodian and in English, when they were cooked, when they were eaten. The food is so much a part of their family and their culture and their daily life. And most Americans don't eat that way. They don't understand food that way.
So they've really brought something of their traditions and the marvelous variety of their traditions.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that runs throughout the book, is the biodiversity of these ethnic gardens is astonishing, absolutely astonishing. And it represents a kind of botanical wealth that is really important to all of us.
Now, another kind of exchange that you talk about in the book is in connection to Nuestras Raíces, which is an urban garden in Holyoke. And there's an interchange between the old and the young.
Yes, that was very moving for me. I met several of the elder men who are retired migrant farm workers, and some of the teenage boys translated for me, and one of the ones I spent the most time with was Candido Nieves. He was 13 when I met him several years ago, and he sat on this bench at La Sanquita, the first garden, and translated for the elders, Heriberto Santiago among them. And I learned a great deal firsthand from these men about the pride they had in their ability to work and their skill, but also the terrible conditions under which they worked. And then afterwards, when I was walking the garden after the elders left, Candido and I were walking through La Finquita, and I asked him if he'd show me his favorite part of the garden. And he did, with this eloquence and this tenderness and love that just took my breath away. And I realized it was the product of him having been encouraged to garden for 6 years with the men, the older men, teaching the boys how to grow things, what their meaning is, and the kind of respect this 13-year-old had for the earth and for plants was really quite impressive to me, and that was a gift of the elders to him.
Patricia Klindienst. Her book is The Earth Knows My Name, Food, Culture, and Sustainability in the Gardens of Ethnic Americans. And, full disclosure, the name and original idea for Nuestras Raíces leapt into my mind one day while working in my own garden. I was a social worker then in Holyoke working with poor families, and it seemed that doing agriculture in the city would be so much more healing for my clients than the therapeutic band-aids the mental health system was putting on them. The idea of Nuestras Raíces took root in Holyoke's Latino community and was grown and nurtured by many hands and hearts to become the community powerhouse it is today. Go to writersvoice.net for links to find out more about the project. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.